Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 23, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call on Peña Rodriguez v. Colorado, a post-decision recap. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, John Richter, a partner at King & Spalding. He'll present, and then we will open the floor for your questions. Thanks for speaking with us today, John. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Appreciate your calling in for this. The Supreme Court recently reached a decision on March 6th in the Peña Rodriguez versus Colorado case. And for those of you who have not read the decision or followed it closely, I'll give a brief recap. The case was decided with Justice Kennedy delivering the opinion of the court, which voted 5-3 in favor of Peña Rodriguez. And with Justices Alito and Thomas filing dissenting opinions, and Judge Alito's dissenting opinion was joined by Thomas and the Chief Justice. The key facts of the case are that Colorado had brought criminal charges against Peña Rodriguez based on allegations that he had sexually assaulted two teenage sisters at a horse racing facility. He was convicted on one charge, and I think there was a hung jury on another charge. After the jury returned the guilty verdict, two jurors reported to defense counsel that one juror during deliberation had expressed certain statements toward the defendant and a potential alibi witness. Specifically, according to the court record, this juror reported to defense counsel that, quote, he believed the defendant was guilty because, in his experience as an ex-law enforcement officer, Mexican men had a bravado that caused them to believe they could do whatever they wanted with women, unquote. And this juror also reported that the other juror had made statements that he thought the defendant, quote, did it because he's Mexican and Mexican men take whatever they want, unquote, and that, quote, 9 times out of 10 Mexican men were guilty of being aggressive toward women and young girls, unquote. At the trial level, the court, the defense counsel, not surprisingly, filed a motion for new trial and seeking an exception to Colorado's rule of evidence 606B that essentially barred efforts to impeach a jury's verdict and prohibited a juror from testifying as to any statement made during deliberations in a proceeding inquiring into the validity of the verdict. This case was important as it moved up. Obviously, it was upheld in the Colorado State Court system, and then petition for cert was granted. This decision had import because Colorado's Colorado's rule of evidence 606B was duplicative of the federal rule of evidence 606B, and therefore and similar, obviously, to many state rules that are patterned on the federal rule. And so the import of this decision is certainly one that is going to have wide application across the United States at both the federal and the state level. In terms of background, going into this case, essentially no impeachment rules, which generally prohibit inquiry into jury deliberations when challenging a verdict, have had a long history in the common law in England and in the United States, and that stemmed as far back as the 18th century in a ruling by Lord Mansfield that essentially was the basis for a lot of the American jurisprudence on this, developed at common law before the federal rules of evidence were codified and passed in 1975. Interestingly, as a side note, Lord Mansfield, since this case is about essentially racial, the question of inquiry into racial bias in jury deliberations, Lord Mansfield is most famously known for his ruling in 1772, in which he held that slavery was not recognized under English law, and that therefore slaves who were brought to England were deemed to be immediately freed in England. So the background in the United States prior to the codification of 606B in 1975 was that while many states had this no impeachment rule, there were exceptions to that. The state of Iowa and the so-called Iowa rule had been adopted in some states to provide a little more flexibility, and basically it still prevented jurors from testifying about their own subjective beliefs, but they could testify about objective facts and events that occurred during deliberations. And if you look back at the legislative history of the consideration of Federal Rule of Evidence 606B, both the Advisory Committee on the Federal Rules of Evidence as well as the House of Representatives had considered a more flexible rule than ultimately the rule that was codified at 606B. Again, prior to the rule being adopted, it's clear that there's been a fair amount of back and forth and debate about where the line ought to be drawn in terms of how far you should allow counsel, and usually counsel who is disappointed by the verdict, to potentially open the door and seek information from jurors about the verdict in order to potentially challenge it post-trial. The underlying theory ultimately that embodied 606B was that a rule that pretty much prevented most attempts to impeach a jury's verdict had the maximum to the maximum extent would promote full and vigorous discussion by jurors, and that would, and given that these are people who are not volunteers and who are not full-time participants in the justice system, would reduce any attempts to harass or annoy them post-trial. The Supreme Court, prior to the adoption of 606B, had rendered a number of different decisions that, as not too surprisingly, ranged from adoption of the no impeachment rule that ultimately was codified in 606B to also a late 19th century case that seemed to suggest that there might be some circumstances in which certain allegations that were brought to light might be considered. After the adoption of the rule at the federal level, the Supreme Court, in a couple of cases, rejected challenges and rejected the suggestion that there should be some Sixth Amendment exception for evidence. In a case called Tanner, that was involved jurors who were under the influence of drugs and alcohol during the time of their deliberation, and that was found to not give rise to at least constitutional dimension in terms of a Sixth Amendment challenge to the 606B rule. A case called Warger, where a jury forewoman had allegedly failed to disclose a certain pro-defendant bias during voir dire, and it was discovered after the verdict that she had lied during voir dire, and the court nonetheless upheld 606B's sort of more absolute nature in the Warger case. In the court's opinion rendered in March 6, the court held that where a juror makes a clear statement that he or she relied on racial stereotypes or animus to convict a criminal defendant, the Sixth Amendment requires that the no impeachment rule give way in order to permit the trial court to consider the evidence of a juror's statement and any resulting denial of the jury trial guarantee. Justifying its departure from the prior precedent, and obviously creating what effectively is an exception now to federal rule of evidence and obviously Colorado rule of evidence 606B, the court, in the majority opinion, distinguished the prior cases in a couple of ways. First, the court asserted that the conduct, while troubling in those prior cases, Tanner and Warger, was anomalous behavior from a single jury, and sought to suggest that, in contrast, racial bias is a familiar and reoccurring evil that, if left unaddressed, would risk systemic injury to the administration of justice. In other words, the majority opinion framed racial bias as a problem of, greater significance than, say, the circumstances that had been found in Tanner with drunk and high jurors or other types of biases. And in its reasoning, the majority follows a somewhat familiar path in terms of making use of the Civil War amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment, and emphasizing, as it's done in certain other cases in the past, that when it comes to issues of race in the civil and criminal justice system, that exceptions need to be made, and so the court emphasized and relied on prior precedents in terms of prohibiting exclusion of jurors on the basis of race, guarding against discrimination of jurors in jury selection, and permitting defendants to ask questions about racial bias during voir dire, as other instances in which the court has created exceptions in order to enforce the Constitution's guarantee against state-sponsored racial discrimination in the jury system. The court also relied on the fact that there were about 17 other jurisdictions that have recognized a racial bias exception to their no impeachment rule at the state level, therefore the court ultimately held that in this case the trial court in Colorado had erred, and the Supreme Court of Colorado had erred in upholding the trial court's denial of the motion of consideration of the motion for new trial. I think the import of the majority decision is ultimately that in cases like Pena-Rodriguez, it means that the trial court must conduct an inquiry develop a fuller record before making a ruling on the motion for new trial. In terms of the dissent in the case, I think the interesting part of the dissent is how it plays in relation to the majority opinion because it has many parallels to, I think, the jurisprudential debate that continues ongoing and that is obviously presently going before the Senate Judiciary Committee with the consideration of Judge Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. And the question of competing judicial philosophies in approach to constitutional decision making. The dissenting justices looked at the history of the federal no impeachment rule, and obviously the codification of the federal rules of evidence, and obviously were critical of the court's willingness to depart from that precedent, particularly given that the federal rule had passed through a democratic process. The federal rules of evidence, when they were finally adopted in 1975, had undergone several years of pretty heavy scrutiny by Congress. The dissent made it clear that, in their view, nothing in the text or history of the Sixth Amendment or in the inherent nature of the jury trial right and the right to a fair trial suggested that the extent of the protection provided by the amendment depended on the nature of the jury's partiality or bias. And particularly Justice Thomas, in his separate dissenting opinion, engaged in a pretty rigorous originalist examination of the history of the Sixth Amendment, the history of the no impeachment rules as they existed at the time of the adoption of the Sixth Amendment, as well as at the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment, which the majority had relied on, to suggest that the no impeachment rule was the dominant rule at that time, and that therefore, while Congress was certainly right and Democratic legislatures were certainly had the right to allow for exceptions to the 606B rule, and that the line could be drawn differently than it was drawn under 606B, that it was not of constitutional magnitude, and that the court therefore was again usurping the democratic process instead of in making an ostensibly constitutional ruling. In terms of the impact of this going forward, I think there are a couple things. One, this certainly does mean that there is now an exception across the board in cases in which potential racial bias can be there's evidence of potential racial bias, and so defense counsel in both criminal and civil cases now can certainly examine that and seek to if they find evidence of it, seek to pursue post-verdict, post-trial motions to attempt to overturn a verdict. The court, in the majority opinion, did not provide very clear guidance on how the rule ought to be applied, leaving essentially discretion to the trial court to determine what a clear statement that involved racial bias might be, and also leaving to the courts exactly how to inquire as to whether a verdict should be set aside. And the court also noted, the majority court did note that not every offhand comment indicating any racial bias or hostility would justify setting aside the no impeachment bar. It remains to be seen, therefore, how this is going to play out. I think it does mean that we should expect that litigators in both civil and criminal cases are going to be further empowered post-jury trial in communicating with jurors. It raises questions, particularly for criminal defense counsel, as to whether not pursuing questioning of jurors to ferret out potential instances of racial bias or hostility, could constitute a a failure to represent that party adequately under the circumstances. Most state ethical rules do allow for lawyers to contact jurors after a trial. There are certain restrictions on that, and the ABA rules and the model rules, as well as state ethics and professional responsibility rules, allow for communication, but there are certain limits on that. It'll be how and the degree to which this gets institutionalized will have to be played out across the states where this has not been the practice. As the court had noted, however, in about 17 states, they're already this exception has already existed. And for those states, this is not likely to be a drastic change. It does mean that it does raise questions about whether the justification for the unfairness based on racial hostility is justifiable when compared to other types of unfairness or bias or hostility. And there's still certain that those fights presumably remain to be fought another day, because it doesn't take much imagination to contemplate additional biases and hostility that would be just as unfair to a litigant as one involving racial bias or hostility. In terms of the overall impact of this decision, I think another factor to consider is, regardless of your view on it, is that this is a decision being made about jury verdicts at a time in which jury trials are at an all-time low in the federal and the state level. We are certainly seeing jury trials vanish in many respects at both the federal and the state level, and there are many reasons for that. But this certainly is occurring and potentially opens the door to an additional challenge in a circumstance which constitutes a very, very small percentage of the total number of cases that are filed nationwide in both the civil and criminal arenas. So that's a quick summary of things. I think ultimately the majority opinion and the dissenting opinions reflect the competing constitutional philosophies for approaching many questions, and we've seen that certainly in other criminal cases that the Supreme Court has considered over the years. And it therefore obviously highlights again why these different approaches and the role of the judges believe they play in terms of making decisions that have and interpretations of our Constitution can have real impact in the outcome of particular cases, even if, as in this case, this is simply drawing the line in a slightly different place that many states have already drawn it. So I'll open it up to questions at this point, and thanks for the listening.
All right. Thanks very much, Sean. I'm now going to open up the floor to questions. In a moment, we're going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for some questions to queue up, let me make a quick programming note. Our next teleforum is tomorrow, the 24th, at 1 o'clock p.m. That's on deep pocket jurisprudence and meaningful civil justice reform with Victor Schwartz. Again, if you'd like to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. We'll answer questions in the order in which they're received, and our lines are wide open right now. So while we wait on some let's go right to our first audience question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Bob Fitzpatrick in D.C. Couple of questions, if I may.
Sure.
What implications does this have for those judges who, as some do, prohibit counsel from having discussions with jurors after trial? What implications does this have for an evidentiary hearing and maybe even discovery, depositions, subpoenas post-trial to establish unfairness? And I guess lastly, does this have implications for jurors' discussions of sex, gender, religion, Muslims, and politically incorrect language, illegal so-called undocumented workers, in particularly FLSA cases, where there are cases being filed around the country by so-called undocumented workers.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of questions. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll try to take those on best I can follow. I mean, I think for the easy one is the first one you asked, which is what's the implication for local rules or particular judge imposed rules that strictly forbid lawyers from contacting or having any contact with jurors post verdict. I think this opinion calls into deep question any kind of absolute prohibition on contact. I think the reality is most states. I haven't done a 50-state survey, but I think the overwhelming rules, and certainly the model professional rules, allow lawyers to contact jurors, and particularly in this instance now, where there is any possible basis to believe that there would be a need, that there could have been such you know, some kind of racial bias or hostility that could be present, it's going to be hard for a court to deny that. Now, obviously, it leaves for another day what your initial threshold would be for making such contact. But I think for defense counsel, for criminal defense counsel, I think they're going to be on pretty strong ground to suggest that they have a right to make reasonable inquiry of jurors to see whether any racial bias or hostility could have contributed to a verdict. And a judge, you know, at this point, we won't know exactly the degree to which you need to have, you can just go on a fishing expedition, generally speaking, or whether you need to have something that's come to your attention to trigger further inquiry. Certainly the ethical rules would allow, in most instances, in most jurisdictions that I can tell, would allow lawyers or lawyer representatives through private investigators to potentially reach out to jurors post-verdict about the case generally, so long as they are clear in how they present themselves, make it clear to the juror that they do not have to speak to them, and obviously do not conduct themselves in a way that could be deemed to be harassment or annoying to the juror. As far as the broader question of what's the implication for this in other cases, you know, I think at an intellectual level, it's hard to see how once you open the door to inquiry for one kind of bias or hostility, given that it's seeking a fair trial, that it doesn't potentially give rise to other categories of alleged unfairness that could possibly be grounds. And certainly in the states that have recognized an exception, that has come up. You know, for example, in New Jersey, it appears to have to include an exception for religion. There is in Wisconsin, the exception, it basically a jury verdict, they have a rule that says whenever it comes to a trial court's attention that a jury verdict may have been the result of any form of prejudice based on race, religion, gender, or national origin, judges should be especially sensitive to such allegations and conduct an investigation to ferret out the truth. So, you know, different states have come at this differently. At this point, what we know is that there is a hard and fast rule now that is going to be have to be applied at the federal level and across all states for race for instances of alleged racial bias or hostility, but I would expect enterprising counsel to seek to expand that rule based on other categories that are commonly recognized.
Thanks, I appreciate it. It's helpful.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Right now, our lines are open. John, if there's anything else you'd like to get into while we wait for some questions to queue up?
Well, at a practical level, in terms of just thinking, you know, the rules on, I can just address a little bit about how lawyers can communicate with jurors after a jury trial is completed, at least at a general level. You know, the ethical rules, at least based on the model rules, contemplate that litigators may desire post-verdict contact with jurors in certain cases. You know, it's generally defined either for two reasons are used to justify the contact. Either it is to find out whether there's been some kind of misconduct that led to an erroneous verdict in some fashion, or allow a party to challenge the outcome of the case. Or it's for the more educational purpose, which is to determine why the case turned out the way it did, and for the trial lawyer in the case to learn what worked and what didn't. But inherent in these rules is a juror's right to choose whether to talk or not. The rules necessarily mean that the lawyer or their agents, such as paralegals or investigators, have to identify themselves and tell whom they represent. They need to be clear that the juror certainly has the right to refuse the interview. In my experience, many jurors want to talk and enjoy talking to lawyers, but not all of them. I think in terms of in this new world, given the court's ruling, I think it probably will behoove courts to make sure, and some trial judges do this already, that they instruct jurors that they have the right to either discuss or refuse to discuss a case with anyone, including counsel or members of the press. In terms of the contacts themselves, basically, I think the approach would be to make sure that if you're approaching, a lawyer needs to identify whom they represent, why they're contacting the juror, and that the juror has the right to refuse to talk to them and has the right to review and receive a copy of any declaration that might be filed afterwards. It may also be the case that the lawyer probably should be asking questions in an open-ended fashion, so as to make sure that he or she is not essentially leading a juror to say something that, in fact, ultimately proves to not be borne out by the facts.
Let me make one final call for questions here. If you'd like to join the queue, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. And I'll make another programming note. Again, our next teleforum is tomorrow at 1 o'clock p.m. It's on Deep Pocket Jurisprudence and Meaningful Civil Justice Reform with Victor Schwartz. Seeing no questions, John, I'll turn it back over to you for any final thoughts that you might have.
Nothing additional, Tim. Appreciate your hosting, and thanks, everyone, for listening today.
Great. Thank you so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank our expert for joining us today. Please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.